Welcome, a listener, to another episode of Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug. This is episode 106 of the podcast, and we have another great discussion lined up for you. This week, Linguistic Dragon joins us again. Always good to have him on the podcast. And we tackle the topic of abstraction, the simplification of complex systems, and why it's so important that abstraction is a component of game design. Also, do have a few shout outs and the like, in particular, two new Patreon patrons, Brickbat and Penteus Pedalici. Thank you both for your support. Happy to have you. And as always, of course, if you out there, good listener, would like to back the podcast, you can do so, patreon.com/Ultima Codex. We also have a bunch of new Ultima Dragons to welcome this week, at least on Facebook and Google Plus. On Facebook in particular, to the UDIC group there, we welcome Sean, David, Bridget, Charles, Matthew, Arthur, Adam, Jonathan, Eddie, Matt, Stuart, Sven, James, Michael, David, another Michael, yet another Michael, James, Jean-Stéphane, Greg, Bill, Russell, Steve, Ian, Lynette, Ted, Thomas, Scott, and Jeremy. And on Google Plus, we welcome David and Michael. Splut to all. Also, just a reminder, we are now hosted on Anchor.fm, a new and much more social podcast hosting platform. You can find us at anchor.fm/SSSH podcast and take advantage of some of the community features there. In particular, you can leave us voice messages up to a minute in duration, and you can give our episodes applause. And if you're listening in the Anchor app on iOS and Android, there may be other options to engage with us as well. For those of you who do the smart home thing, you can find us live on Apple HomePod. Try saying, "Hey Siri, play the podcast Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug." And we should also be available on Google Home. So you can also try saying to your Google Home device, "Hey Google, play the podcast Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug," and see what happens. And of course, as always, this episode of Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug is brought to you by our Patreon backers. So thank you to everyone who supports the podcast and the Codex by that means. And in particular, a hearty thank you to our co-producers, Seth, Dominic, Chris, Violation, Adam, Eric, Thorwan, Pascal, Helgraf, Aaron, Hearth of Britannia, Edward, Stirring Dragon, Cranberry, Slegnor, Bruce, Christopher, Gradia, Shamino, and now, Brickbat, and Penteus. And now, enjoy the show. How are you this fine day?
So far, so good.
Well, that's good.
Not been a whole lot of it yet.
No, I suppose not. You've just rolled out of bed.
Essentially.
Well. Not much different for me, actually. I mean, I woke up a little under an hour ago, quickly dressed and hopped in the car.
And here we are.
I don't know about you, but I'm standing in one of the storage rooms. There's lots of network cable and material for making other cables. Why do we have so many components for serial cables? Anyway.
Your guess is as good as mine.
Artifacts of a bygone age. That's a real challenge these days. You know, like, it's hard enough to get like a laptop with a CD-ROM drive or a, you know, some kind of optical drive still included in it. But seriously, try and get a, well, laptop or anything that still has a serial port. The last time I looked, it was an option. An upgrade option, well, or like an extra charge option on Panasonic Toughbooks.
Wow.
Yeah. So, for those of you who have to maintain embedded devices, Panasonic Toughbooks. Anyway, so that is not, I didn't want to talk about Panasonic Toughbooks this morning, but I'm just literally staring at like, there's like 50 ends of serial cables here, you know, for like making your own. Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, actually Klortos suggested a quite good topic in the UDIC Discord, which, you know, I mean, I imagine we can probably chew through and, well, I don't know, we may not be able to do it justice with the time we have, but it might be fun to at least poke around with.
Let's find out.
Yes, exactly. So this is, what got into it is, you know, because we were talking a little bit on the UDIC Discord yesterday about, just how important is abstraction in an RPG? And I mean, I guess it's important maybe to define, because if you put abstraction into Google, you're going to get a lot of different definitions back. You know, the
some of which are rather abstract in and of themselves.
I know, right? So like the main definition of abstraction is the quality of dealing with ideas rather than events, or something that exists only as an idea. But the thing is, in computer science, abstraction has a slightly different meaning. Okay, so you know, in sort of the general parlance, abstraction is the main sense, I'm just going by Wikipedia here, the main sense, in the main sense, is a conceptual process where general rules and concepts are derived from the usage and classification of specific examples, literal, real or concrete signifiers, first principles, or other methods. Computer science, though, kind of takes that in a bit of a different direction. And in computer science, when we talk about abstraction, we're generally talking about a technique for hiding complexity. It works by establishing a level of simplicity on which a person interacts with the system, suppressing the more complex details below the current level. So think of something like a GUI. A GUI is an abstraction, right? If you want to step past the GUI and into command line, you're going to find out about some of that underlying complexity. And the command line is itself an abstraction. If you want to step past the command line and get into the raw machine code, have fun with that.
No, thank you.
But it also applies in games, too. And the example that I used in particular with Clordos was, you know, abstraction would, to me, seem to be the difference between the very raw and often terrifying experience of surviving in a vast, unknown, hostile wilderness by your wits alone, and the rather pleasant experience of exploring an open world while having to deal with the occasional intrusion of the hunger mechanic. Because that's often, you know, that's like, I mean, there are games, Kingdom Come Deliverance comes to mind, that purport.
Doesn't it usually?
Well, sometimes. it's an interesting title. But there are games like that which, you know, purport to deliver a more, quote, realistic, unquote, experience. And, you know, even from the reviews I've read, Kingdom Come doesn't necessarily manage to do this entirely well. But, you know, like their big thing in the game was, you know, like they wanted the combat engine to be particularly realistic. So, you know, it's not just, well, I'm just going to hit the other guy with my sword. It's like, you know, the swords, they really, you know, take the fact that the swords are, or whatever weapons you're using, are like 3D objects in the game very, very seriously. So there's, you know, blows and parrying and like all of this stuff. They really try to, you know, get, I guess, the physics of the sword fight, very, very accurate. Also things like, you know, if you get wounded in the game, well, that has particular effects, some of which can be longer term and, you know, can kind of weaken you over time. I think food poisoning is a thing. So like, you know, if you keep food in your backpack too long, right, and then you eat it and it's, oh, I feel sick. So it's like, and on the one hand, like, I guess it's, there have been some other, like, you know, survival focused games that have, you know, again, like really tried to challenge the goal almost seems to, what was it? The Long Dark is another one that kind of came up there for a while again. I don't know if it was necessarily like hyper realistic, but it was, you know, very much this whole idea of, well, you're like, you know, here's a dark, lonely wilderness. See how long you can survive for. And in some cases, it's not that long at
That's
all.
It's not very long at all.
And I mean, like, okay, you know, like I can see that there's, I can see that the point or the merit of, you know, wanting to, you know, occasionally produce a game that explores these things, because these are things that, you know, can in fact happen in real life. I mean, a lot of what I try and teach the youth in scouting is exactly this, right? It's like, okay, well, you're lost in the woods. What do you do?
But the answer is not, is preferably not panic.
Well, yeah, don't panic, hug a tree. But, you know, like it's, so obviously there's a real world case for this, right? Because, you know, this stuff does occasionally happen. Maybe not occasionally, that might be the wrong word to use in some parts of the world. This is a very frequent thing in our Western culture, North American culture, whatever, maybe not so often, but you know, this is a thing that happens. And this is, you know, like people do have these experiences, right? Where it's, you know, someone is lost or is otherwise, you know, kind of just thrust upon the elements and has to survive by their wits. And that doesn't always work out for them. But notably, it's rarely fun. And games are ideally supposed to be fun.
ostensibly.
Least, yeah, you know, some outliers, maybe, but the general concept of a game has to do with entertainment. And so we need a little bit, I think, of abstraction. You know, we need to, we need a way to, you know, still kind of convey some of the same emotions and some of the same tension of, say, being lost in the woods and having to survive by your wits alone, without necessarily tapping into the complete raw terror of that experience.
I'm put in mind of the old adage that, that perfection is not achieved when there is nothing left to add, but when there is nothing left to take away.
There's something to that.
Yeah, there is. I mean, it's a matter of deciding what it is, how it is you want to challenge the player in the game, what the purpose is, and then kind of abstracting everything that doesn't add to it in some way or another. When you first brought up the topic, my mind went not to RPGs, but to strategy games, in fact. I'm also a rather big fan of the Civilization series.
Yes.
I remember reading this article by a guy playing through his first cultural victory in Civilization VI. And one of the ways that can be accomplished is by, you know, gathering great works of art and music and that sort of thing and stashing them in your museums and opera houses and all that artistic sort of thing.
Okay.
And you get bonuses for theming your museums and your archaeological museums and that sort of thing. So you get a bonus if you have like three works of art of the same type by different artists in the same museum or artifacts from the same era from different cultures.
This is Civilization, right? We didn't inadvertently stumble into like some advanced version of Sim City where you're like trying to, you know, set up multiple museums around town.
Yes, this is Civilization we're talking about.
Okay, go on.
But there's a menu where you can see, you know, all your artifacts and paintings and sculptures and where they're located and, you know, whether a certain museum is themed or not for the bonus. And the guy making his way through, you know, trying to figure out the system, was talking about how, do we really need to actually do all the shuffling of all of our artifacts and paintings ourselves in order to get the bonus? The challenge for the player is in figuring out what types of works of art or artifacts that you need in order to get that bonus. Does it really add to also give them the challenge of shuffling everything around themselves in order to obtain that bonus?
You can only win this game culturally if you can tell your Baroque from your Romantic. Goodness.
And if it's not Baroque, don't fix it.
Yes, exactly. Oh my God. Yeah, that's a place where it sounds like a little abstraction is needed. I mean, like, I can guess, I guess, you know, maybe like, you can kind of stick under like general headers, right? Like, you know, we have a dinosaur museum in Alberta, right? So, you know, like there's an obvious theme. Hey, look, there's a museum entirely about like dinosaur fossils. Okay, that totally makes sense. But then we also have the Royal Alberta Museum, which is, you know, everything under the sun, including occasionally dinosaurs. So, you know, it's like, I don't know. But I mean, like, on the one hand, that's cool. And I guess, too, like, in a way, like, there's a little bit of user education that goes along with that. But at the same time, it's like, do I care? Like, I have all these paintings. This is the painting museum, and that's the statue museum, and that's the this, and that's the, you know, that's, I imagine how most users, I mean, I'm assuming the game is going to present to the user, like, you know, okay, well, this is this kind of painting or this kind of artifact. And yeah, so, you know, you have some indicators as data. But yeah, who, you know, on the other hand, of the vast number of people who are going to be playing the game, how many actually care?
Yeah. The challenge isn't getting all of it that you need rather than figuring out where all of it's supposed to go.
Yeah. So
adding that extra step doesn't really add anything.
It's sort of like, it's like the backpack in Ultima 7, right? The backpack in Ultima 7. And I know, jump on me for saying this, because everybody loves the Gumps. But honestly, the experience of rifling through the backpack in Ultima 7 was too depressingly like the experience of rifling through my backpack in real life.
Where's the key?
Yeah, I know it's in here somewhere. It's got to be. Maybe it's under the that thing. I don't know.
Where did I put the serpent ring? I know it's in here somewhere.
Exactly. And, you know, like, I mean, I get it. I like the Gumps too. I like the visual presentation, and there's a certain immersive aspect to that. But, you know, like, yeah, the U7 backpack, the Ultima 7 backpack, it gets cluttered, and it gets cluttered fast. And you can definitely see the appeal of, especially with when it's one of those damn keys, right? Because the keys in the game are so tiny, and they inevitably wind up hiding under like some other larger object.
And there's so many of them.
I know. It's like, so, you know, after you've gone through the experience.
Did I use this one already? Is there one that I'm missing somewhere?
Yeah. Was it the pink one? Gosh. So after you've gone through the experience of like trying to find the right key for like the fifth time in a row, and granted, like Exalt to its credit, gets rid of some of this. Exalt, you know, basically, if you have the key in your inventory, when you come to the door, you can just double click it and it opens. That's a nice little feature that they added. But I'm talking base game Ultima 7. After you've gone through this experience four or five times of, you know, just like trying to find the right damn key for the door, and it's buried under like the beef jerky in your backpack, and it's the same color as the beef jerky, so you can't hardly tell it apart. You start to see the appeal of list-based inventories.
Yeah.
So actually, Shroud of the Avatar too. Like, I don't know if they still have the Gumps. They had them for a while. Sorgorn might have been complaining that they removed them. I honestly can't remember. I used the Gump-based inventory in SOTA for all of one play session, and after realizing just how much of an impediment it was to using, say, the crafting system effectively. List-based.
Take all of that stress out.
Yeah. And, you know, for as much as Ultima 6's inventory management gets knocked, and for good reason, like it's cumbersome in its own ways, at least it's not hard to find things.
Yeah.
So, anyways.
It's more the standard inventory Tetris rather than, what's a good comparison for Ultima 7's version of it?
Literally, it's just like rifling through my backpack after, you know, 6 months at school. Saying, hey, I was looking for this pen.
And Clutter like, Sorter Adventure number 7.
You know, you could probably make a really great mobile app out of that, but someone would probably play it, actually. And I guess, like, that's the thing, too, is, like, you know, and I mean, there is a market for these games that kind of don't abstract away as much. But I think, you know, in the general case and for the general player, it's good to be able to take some of these more complex or irksome or terrifying aspects of real life and represent them to the player in a way that, you know, still maybe tries to convey some of the severity of whatever the particular thing is, but, you know, also kind of simplifies it, and maybe even in some ways, term that I absolutely hate, but maybe it's applicable here, gamifies it, right? You know, even something like the hunger mechanic in, say, Ultima 7, right? Because, you know, if you're out exploring the wilderness all day long, yeah, soon enough, you're going to get hungry. And as annoying as the hunger mechanic is, though, it's kind of that reminder that, you know, all right, well, I'm just not this, you know, invincible hero who's able to just wander the shores of this world for days on end without any concerns or cares or what have you. Right. I still need to eat. Okay. Well,
that's another thing though, because, you know, a lot of the Ultima games have a hunger mechanic. They just handle it differently. And some of them are more abstract than others. I mean, Ultima 4 and 5, you just have a stack of food that you constantly eat as you adventure through the game. And if you don't have any, you start taking damage because you're starving. Right. And Ultima 6, food is only important so long as you're resting, because if you don't have food when you're resting, then you don't heal when you rest.
Yes, which, so it's kind of like, and there's a pendulum swing there, right? Because, you know, like on the one hand, yeah, you have games, and going back as far as a Calibeth, right? I think, or at least, you know, some of the early Ultimas, going back really, really far into the, if you don't have enough food,
you die.
And in some cases, it's literally like every step you take in the game, you are also consuming food. It's like basically you have fuel. And
that's what makes the ship so handy in Ultima 2, because you don't use food when you're on it.
Ah, yes, that's right. So, and you really have to start treating it almost like fuel. It's like, okay, well, I know I have this much food, which means I can go this far away from the city before I have to book it back and buy more food. No wonder Doug, you know, I love Doug the Eagle's presentation of this as being, you know, like food is like the ultimate drug in Britannia.
Right? You can't live without it.
Yeah, everybody's a food junkie and they constantly need it, and they will die very quickly without it from the withdrawal symptoms.
Oh boy, I shudder to think of the rehab clinics for that. Food Eaters food, Anonymous.
Yes. And then, of course, the create food spell came along at some point. But I often have to wonder about that. Like, you know, in a Britannia where the create food spell exists, what's the point of being a farmer? Anyway.
Because what happens if something happens to the ether and all of your mages go crazy?
Ah, that's true, too. That's true, too.
I mean, it's not like that ever happened.
No, no. It's not like we'll find some sort of magical rock of a particularly dark hue within the bowels of the earth that happens to inhibit the flow of magic entirely around it.
What are the odds of that?
Yeah, pretty low, I think. But you know, like, kind of continuing on with the point, right? It's like, yeah, the first few Ultimas, food is an aggressive mechanic in the game. And then you get Ultima 6, and it's just like, oh, right, food. Well, as long as you have, like, a snack around the campfire, you're probably good. And then Ultima 7, of course, it's almost like, you know, pendulum swings, right? It's like you have really crazy hardcore hunger mechanic for, like, a few games in the series, and then they're just kind of like, oh, right, we'll just back it off. It'll be like this thing that barely matters in the game at all. Because it's not like that's the only way you heal, right? You know, you don't take damage if everybody goes to bed with an empty tummy. You just, you know, yeah,
don't they don't get the hit points back.
But whatever, you just orb of the moons to Lord British, and well, that's not a problem.
Ta-da!
And then, of course, Ultima 7 kind of brings it back a little bit towards the middle. You know, you don't have to constantly eat food, but two or three times a day, you know, the companions are going to be like, I could use a little food. I'm hungry. Of course, that very quickly sometimes turns into I'm starving and taking damage. But, you know,
YOLO, why do you have to eat so much?
Yes. Here, have your third whole chicken of the day, please. So, but, you know, like, I mean, it's more moderate, right? Like, it's sort of, it still kind of puts it out there, and it still, you know, captures some of the challenges that, you know, would-be explorers would legitimately face, but without, you know, making it completely dire. Oh my gosh, if I don't have this for the next 5 minutes, I'm going to wipe my party by walking around.
Well, that's the thing with lava in games too. Why am I not taking damage when I am standing right next to this big, huge lava flow?
Yeah, that's true too. It's like if I stand on the lava flow, I'll take damage. Although notably, I don't instantly die. But yeah, if I'm like right next to the lava flow, yeah, you'd think that I'd still be like getting some secondary burns off of that. Yeah, especially if I'm wearing like plate armor. It's like, wow, my entire body is covered in a frying pan.
Why am I not trying?
Yeah, why does this not hurt? It must be magical. It's magical lava.
The heat only goes... that's what magic plate is for.
Yes, exactly. The heat off the lava only goes straight up, and magic plate has wonderful insulative properties. But yeah, again, you know, that's another good example, though, right? It's like, oh, hey, there's lava. Well, I mean, obviously that's a threat and it's, you know, an obstacle that I have to somehow navigate around. But with none of the other things that lava tends to do, like bubble or flow.
Or burn.
Or burn things that get even kind of within its proximity. Again, you know, abstracting away sort of the more raw, terrible, horrible bits of it and just, you know, representing it to the user as, oh, hey, here's a nice challenge. You know, here's something that you have to, here's an obstacle that you have to get around. Now that said, the fumaroles in Ultima 6 were particularly annoying.
I have terrible memories of those things in Hithloth.
Yes. Hithloth and then on the Gargish realm as well. It's just, oh, hey, look, there's one of those things that will just periodically explode and wound half my party quite horribly. It's like, hey, guys.
Or the tremors in the underworld in 5.
Yeah, quite similar. Or I'm trying to think if there was anything really... Well, I mean, I guess the... Oh, right. The Fire Doomstaff in Ultima 7.
oh, yeah.
That's a friendly fire incident just waiting to happen.
Literally.
Yep. It's like, oh, right. I have the Fire Doomstaff. Everybody else is now in combat mode flank. Stand back. Avatar is using the
fire. Stand back. I'm going to try fire.
It's like, is this like a flame wand? Like, is it just shoot like a little bolt of fire? Oh my gosh.
What have I done? I know.
What have I done? I see why it's called what it is. yeah. Except, yeah. Oh, so many. Actually, anything to do with like fire in Ultima 7 tended to end poorly, especially like, you know, if it was like fire fields or the various traps that would shoot fireballs, and then if they accidentally
hit some... made it so hilarious.
I know, it was comedic and yet at the same time frustrating, because it's like, okay, I'm just gonna walk here and oh my gosh, it looks like I just blew up 15 powder kegs.
whoops,
and everybody's dead because of course they are. It's like, hey, we were just fighting a big, and it was even worse when you like had the Fire Doom staff equipped. Well, not even equipped, but like if you had the Fire Doom staff, you never, ever, ever gave the Fire Doom staff to a character who had an ammunition-based weapon. Because invariably they would run out of bolts or arrows or musket shot. And what's the next thing they grab? The staff.
For the nuclear option.
Exactly. YOLO is just painting the landscape with explosions and everybody dies yet again.
Why is it always YOLO when it comes to these things?
I don't know. He's a fun example. I mean, we are called Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug, and he was true. The cheat menu in Ultima 6, so maybe that's why.
Bars are fun.
They are. They are, you know, although bards definitely make for good comedy on the meme side of things, you know. It's like,
oh my, yes.
The crying flautist, you know, when your party is getting wiped, but you're only a bard. Or, you know, like the 3 or 4 gorillas hiding behind the corner and 3 of them have AK-47s and one of them is carrying a guitar. Bard, his companions now get +5 to hit. It's like, all right, but I don't know where I was going with that. Just a random deviation from topic.
That never happens here.
No, not at all. But yes, abstraction. And I mean, like, it's even something like, you know, even something like the concept of hit points, right, is a quite reasonable abstraction from the very ugly reality that is, I just got hit with a sword. I just took out a whole squad of Nazis in the hall and got shot 3 times.
I got slashed with a sword. Why is my arm still here?
Exactly. You know, and then, you know, not having to deal with all of the consequences of that sort of thing.
But I think when it comes to hit points, there's actually a way to abstract it too much. because if rather than giving you numbers, you know, you have this many hit points out of this many hit points total, and instead just go, you've got a lot of hit points left, you only have a little hit points left, that tends to not be very helpful to the player either.
Yeah, and I mean, like, we can point to different Ultima games that do this well or poorly. Like, I mean, I actually liked how in Ultima 9, they more or less just got rid of the numbers, you know, and everything just became a bar of some kind, mm-hmm. right? Your health bar, your mana bar. Was there an oxygen bar when you swam? I think there was.
Yes,
there is. Yeah, like those things. Because, but again, like, those were put on screen in a way that was, you know, like, it was very well represented visually. So it wasn't, you know, so much of a challenge. I always found the potion bottle in Ultima Underworld a little bit unnerving because, you know, like the first time you take damage, the narrow part of the bottle, of course, empties out. And it's like, wow, I just took a ton of damage. It's like, no, that's just the narrow part of the bottle. Like it kind of empties out slower for a little bit. And then, but like, I didn't find Ultima Underworld's presentation of your health and mana as effective.
A little too abstract.
Exactly. Ultima 7, like, Ultima 6 and Ultima 7 are also a good comparison, too, because, like, Ultima 6 kind of gave you a both and, you know, oh, so-and-so mm-hmm. is barely wounded, so-and-so is lightly wounded, so-and-so is heavily wounded, so-and-so is critical. and it would tell you this about the enemies, too, which was handy. But if you wanted to know exactly what the definition of barely wounded or critical happened to be, there was, you know, a little part of the display that you could click to and, oh, okay, Dupre has 3 hit points left. I should do something about that.
Yeah, that's critical.
Yeah. The number's red. I should probably consider that. Ultima 7, I find, didn't do as good of a job about this because it's kind of just like, you know, if you get hit, your character might flash red. If you get hit really hard, maybe the whole screen flashes red. But, and I'm pretty sure, like, you know, you can, if you pull up the individual character Gumps and click through to the stats page, you know, yeah, you can see where their hit points are at, but it's not.
But you have to go through several menus to do it.
Exactly, right? It's like, oh, hey, you know, Santre is, seems to be really quite badly bleeding and running away from the fight. I wonder how he's doing. I. There he is. Click on the heart. Okay. Yeah. Not as convenient just having all of your characters on one screen, like in, say, Ultima 6. So
it's like you enjoy Ultima 6 or something.
Well, again, and I mean, I keep coming back to it because it's, you know, an easy comparison to Ultima 7, but this was true in the earlier Ultimas too, right? There was always that little party display in the corner and right. You could just have a look at it. It's like, oh, okay, everybody's doing all right or not so all right. And then, of course, when they went to this completely GUI-free experience that was the later Ultima games, of course, well, I mean, it wasn't an issue with Ultima 8 and Ultima 9 because you didn't really have to worry about party management. But with Ultima 7, it was a real challenge because, you know, at least in the base version of Ultima 7 and Serpentile, there was not really an easy way for you to just kind of visually look and see how your party was doing, which is another nice thing that Exalt introduced, right? Because you can get the little portraits with the health and mana bars for every member of the party at the top of the screen or the bottom of the screen or wherever you want to put it. So, you know, Exalt is wonderful for, you know, I mean,
you can just drop the 4 off of that sentence.
Yeah, it's wonderful just in general, right? Especially just because it does. It introduces all of these little things that, you know, and again, it what it introduces in a lot of ways is abstraction, right? It's like, I know I have the key somewhere in my backpack, and as long as that is true, then this locked door that the key opens, I can just open and I can go through. You know, I know I have a way. I know the game is tracking numbers for, you know, the health and whatever of my party members. Here's a much easier visual representation of it that just puts it all right in front of me, so I don't have to keep rifling through menus whenever I get the sense that one of my characters might be really, really badly wounded. things like that. So, I mean, you know, some stuff it made more obvious, right? If you had a player who was cursed, or if you had a character who was cursed, or a character who was poisoned, obviously they would get the little border around them, and that's useful at that point. Oh, that one's been poisoned. Okay, good. Well, here, have a red potion. But and actually too, like I did like that, you know, in Ultima it was just, oh hey, so and so's been poisoned, so now they have a green border around them and they periodically take damage as they walk, as opposed to, you know, although there were a couple of things in Ultima 7 that would make characters actually like double over and vomit. I can't remember what they were off the top of my head, but
it's been a while since I played Ultima 7.
But like, you know, in general, it's like, oh wow, you've gotten some really horrible disease from that infested swamp we just walked through. Well, at least the game is just presenting that as,
drink the water?
Yeah, exactly. Ow, I take damage. And not, you know, making you, the player, have to deal with what's actually probably happening, which probably involves a lot more loss of bowel control and things of that nature.
That's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah, well, you know, again, scouting, we kind of try and teach people about the risks of just drinking water randomly in the wilderness. So, yes, goodness, it's, and I mean, like I say, like you can argue the point that, you know, some games do well, and Klortos was kind of getting at this as well too, like, you know, because when I kind of led with, you know, like it's the difference between the horrifying experience of being lost in the woods and the joy of exploring an open world. You know, he kind of came back. So like, well, what about Ultima Underworld? And I'm just like, okay, true. But I'm sure that if I actually had to, you know, delve into the depths of a monster filled volcano with naught but a rusty sword, it would probably be a lot more horrifying than the experience of playing that game actually is.
I mean, it all comes down to the audience that you're trying to appeal to. I mean, some people like that challenge, like that difficulty. I mean, it's the difference between a survival game and, you know, your basic RPG.
Like, I mean, and definitely, there was a market, obviously, for Kingdom Come. There was a market for The Long Dark. You know, like, obviously, these games exist. Don't Starve is another one that comes to mind. You know, these games exist because, yeah, there is a player base for them. You know, there'd be little point in producing them if there wasn't. But, you know, other players prefer the, I mean, maybe the ultimate example is one I keep coming back to periodically. It's Call of Duty, right? You know, I'm pretty sure that combat is nothing or very, very close to nothing. Like, it is portrayed in a Call of Duty game. But equally, you know, Call of Duty is able to abstract away a lot of the horror and terror of a firefight while maintaining the intensity and challenge of a firefight. And, you know, like, they're able to package that up in a way that's very entertaining to people and draws in a very large audience. And good for them for doing so, right? You know, there was another one that I was coming to. Oh, right. You mentioned strategy games earlier, and this got me thinking too, because, like, you know, not so much on the Civilization side. Well, actually, maybe, but like, there are, and I can't even think of the names of some of the titles because, like, these are very, very niche games. But, you know, if you think about something like a Civ or, you know, sort of the real-time strategy, quote-unquote. Honestly, should be called real-time tactical. I don't know why they're called strategy, but that's neither here nor there. But, you know, like your Command and Conquers and whatever else. There is like a subgenre of these things, which is basically like, you know, highly technical, sophisticated. Yes, exactly.
I play Civilization and not Crusader Kings.
So, you know, basically
too.
Taking those concepts and there you go. And actually, from what I've seen, just like clicking around, there's even more, like, there's games that go for even more complexity than that. And you know what? Again, like, I'm sure these exist because there's a market for them and people want to play them. But, you know, at the end of the day, there's a reason that those are the niche games, whereas your Civs and your Command and Conquerors, or I guess not so much Command and Conquer anymore. It's been a while since there's been anything in that series. But, you know, why these mainline titles are the mainline titles, and the niche titles
work because they know what sort of audience they're trying to appeal to.
That's true. Anyways, I should probably think about actually wrapping this up and also having breakfast. But anyways, that was, yes, I'm going to just come. Abstraction is a good thing. It's a good thing in games. It's a very, very good thing in games.
Is it wisely how much is good, how much is too much?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, like, yeah, I guess, you know.
Everything in moderation.
Yeah, and I mean, like, you can make the argument that, you know, some things abstract away too much, right? Like, oh God. Well, I mean, like, this is, and this is kind of the debate in the RPG space a lot of the time, right? Like,
how much is too much?
How much is too much, right? Like, how much can you actually subtract, simplify before you cross the line from, you know, an RPG into what is arguably maybe, this is, you know, this seemed to be the debate around the Mass Effect series, right? You know, the first Mass Effect was very much, I think, you know, an RPG. It had, and I actually really liked the first Mass Effect. Like, the only thing I think they needed to change was the cover system, because they kind of broke it.
I'd agree with that.
But, you know, like with Mass Effect 2, they stripped out and streamlined so much that, and not that Mass Effect 2 wasn't a great game. Like, it was very, very, it was well put together, mechanically sound. The story was grand. You know, like, it was a very fun, good game to play. But I am kind of in the camp that questions whether it can really be called an RPG, because to me, it's like more like an action game, right?
And the comparison I draw is that Mass Effect 1 feels like an RPG with shooter elements, whereas Mass Effect 2 feels like a shooter with RPG elements.
Yeah, that's basically what I was trying to say, but less articulately. right? Because
that's what I'm here for.
There you go. Thank you. Yeah, that's exactly it, right? It's like they kind of simplified too much out of the original Mass Effect concept when they put together, you know, Mass Effect 2. And I mean, again, like, it still had a great story and it was still fun as heck to play. But, you know, you noticed then that with Mass Effect 3, they started to bring some of it back. And with Mass Effect Andromeda, like, Mass Effect Andromeda, I think, kind of represents a return back to the RPG-ish aspect. I would still say that, you know, it's definitely not at the level of a Mass Effect 1, but it's more of an RPG than the last two of its predecessors were. And again, like, it's hard to, like, say that in a way that doesn't sound like you're completely knocking the game. And I guess at some level I'm knocking it a little bit, because, you know, it did kind of make that transition from RPG with action to action with bits and pieces of RPG, while still being, you know, very well told stories and very well put together games. But it's like, you know, I was expecting this to be in this genre, but it seems to be kind of more over in that genre.
There's a reason it took me so long to play it.
There you go. But yeah, like, I mean, that's an example of, you know, maybe oversimplifying things a little bit too much. And, you know, like, granted, like, Mass Effect 1, the inventory management was, like, I mean, sure, there was probably room to, like, streamline the inventory management a little bit. You know, it was menu and list based. And there didn't necessarily seem to be a complete justification for, you know, oh, hey, I have the... You know, like, I'm wearing the Scorpion armor. Do I really need to care that much that, you know, there's, like, Scorpion version 1 through 10? It's basically just more and more advanced armor as you go, right? Like, you know, I mean, you could argue that a lot of that was kind of, it was getting to the point of being cluttery because there wasn't, you know, as much of a clear purpose apart from, oh, okay, well, the version 4 armor is better than the version 3 armor. But... at the same time, like, it was, you know, it did it was more of an RPG. And then that kind of all got abstracted away and replaced with, you know, more of an action game template, which... Now, that said, Mass Effect 2 does tend to come up as more highly regarded than Mass Effect 1, so I don't know what that says about the modern gaming market, but there you go. Still, it was, you know, it was... Dragon Age would be another example, right? Like, I, you know, honestly, apart from the fact that... And this is going to be weird for people who've listened to the podcast a long time, because, of course, I've knocked Dragon Age Origins in the past for having absolutely just terrible, clunky combat. And I'll stand by that. You know, if I could have a game that was basically everything else about it was Dragon Age Origins, but with Dragon Age 2's combat, that would be like the ideal Dragon Age game right there.
Platonic ideal of Dragon Age.
Exactly. You know, because same thing. Like Dragon Age Origins is, in the main, a really excellent RPG. Combat kind of sucks, but the rest of it is just awesome. It's not open world, but it's still like, you know, the areas that you do get to explore, they're vast. There's a lot of detail to them. There's a lot of engaging NPCs. The story is really great. You know, all the little fiddly bits, the crafting and the inventory management, they're all there. And actually, I think are like really in it, like they're there and they're there in a very good and measured way. It's not like, you know, it's not just like a Torchlight or a Diablo where it's just a loot fest. And at the same time, it's not, you know, completely absent.
You know, and you then, you say loot fest and my brain just goes to a big musical convention with nothing but loots.
Speaking of YOLO.
Exactly. I'm too much of a bard myself.
There you go. And then again, you know, and then with Dragon Age 2, a lot of that got pared back and stripped out and simplified, oversimplified, right? And I mean, Dragon Age 2 did fix the one big issue that I had with Dragon Age Origins, which is that the combat in Dragon Age 2 was really, really solid and really, really fun versus the standard Aurora engine type combat that characterized Dragon Age Origins.
The dice rolling.
Exactly. I've said that so many times. It's just like, wow, this is just terrible. But, you know, a lot of the rest of Dragon Age 2 was, yeah, it was kind of an oversimplification of what was already a really good form that had been established with Dragon Age Origins. And they did all right with Inquisition to kind of bring back a lot of that stuff. But it's like, yeah, if I could have just had Dragon Age Origins, but with DA2 combat, and that be DAI, I don't even care then if DAI wouldn't have been open world. It would have just been, you know, like this would have been a great, great game because it abstracts all the, you know, like just the right amount, you know? It's like it's not completely swamping me with inventory management details, but it's also not completely removing them. It's not boring me to death with plotting combat. It's presenting combat in a, you know, it's presenting combat in a way that's fun and engaging, but also important for a game where there's still a lot to explore. Brief. You know, it's like, if you want to make a fighting game, cool, let's make a fighting game. But otherwise, you know, and this is maybe, I think, what Reckoning gets right too, is the fact that, you know, there's plenty of combat in Reckoning, but it's also brief. And then you can just get back to wandering around and soaking in the lush world all around you. So, I don't know. Anyways, I should honestly think about breakfast. So, well, this has been fun. I'm going to have fun cutting this together into an episode, but
yeah, this was a good way to spend a morning.
I agree. Okay, well, this works as a potential occasional recording time, so that's cool. And, we will have to keep that in mind as we go forward. Anyways, you have a good morning and a good day.
You as well.
All right.
If you want to participate more directly in the podcast, you can send us an email at ultimacodex@gmail.com, or if you're feeling a bit braver, you can leave us a voice message in one of three places: the podcast website, our Facebook page, or on anchor.fm. You're also welcome to join us on Discord to chat with us and to lurk or contribute to podcast recordings when they happen. If you want to join the Ultima Dragons, you can do so at UDIC.org, where you can choose your very own dragon name. You can also find the Ultima Dragons on Facebook and on Google+. You can follow at Ultima Dragons on Twitter, or join them on Slack or Discord. And if you're feeling really old school, you can even fire up a Telnet client and check out the Wearmount. If you'd like to support Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug, you can do so at Patreon, where for as little as $1 a month, you can get access to episodes the day before they go live for everyone else. You'll also get access to behind-the-scenes audio on occasion, and possibly other interesting content. But if a monthly subscription isn't your thing, you can always buy your video games at GOG. We are a partner of that fine site, and every time you buy one or more games at GOG via the links on our websites or in the show notes, that helps us out. But we also welcome your moral support. You can like the Ultima series on Facebook, follow at Ultima Codex on Twitter, or leave the podcast a review on iTunes. And you're welcome to share our episodes with your friends and social media circles. Spam, Spam, Spam Humbug is a production of the Ultima Codex. You can find show notes online at spamspamspamhumbug.com. Thank you for listening, and until next time, be virtuous.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.